pleasant good evening to you all. In a few days, a few weeks, we're all going to be singing Peace on Earth, Goodwill Toward Men. And the truth is that there is not peace on earth, goodwill toward men. We are at war with one another. A shocking state of affairs. Tonight we have a specialist that will help us think more clearly about war and Canada in relation to our neighbor and else other forces in the world. But before we start, I think it's a civil thing to do that we should know. Reflecting this community, we should know who we are. And I'm going to ask you to stand and introduce yourself to your neighbor. Just stand up right now, would you? And say hello to your neighbor. It's a terrific honor to have one of our own speak to us tonight. Author of this book, which you can purchase for a very small sum indeed, after the 30, after the program is over. And there is also going to be a reception, and not just ordinary bread and buns and things, something pretty, you know what I mean, out of the ordinary. There is no collection for this either, so rejoice. You know, the Council of Public Affairs is not always this forthcoming, but we are tonight, because this is a special occasion. The speaker, Michael, went to LCI and holds the chair in global politics and international law at the University of British Columbia. And some of you who were here have been members of the Academy and are now still. We'll know that there are research chairs, and some come with considerable baggage in which there is gold and prestige and other things like that. And Michael has that chair at the University of British Columbia. I would not want to speak for him, but I would have thought that the supply of money is unending. And but it's not very often you can say that about the university. But I have heard some discussions with Michael. It seemed to me he's got more than I've ever looked at in the university. Anyway, we are so honored to have him come. Prior to 2004, he was a tenured professor of law and director of Canadian Studies at Duke University. And from 1996 to 1999, he was a fellow of Jesus College at Oxford University. He is a regular contributor to the London Review of Books, and if you read the Globe and Mail as intensely as I do, you can see him frequently on the op-ed page of the Globe and Mail, the last page of section one of the Globe. There he is in the middle of the page, telling the truth, his truth, for everyone. He is author of most recently this book, War Law, Understanding International Law and Armed Conflict, published by Douglas McIntyre, 2005. This is the first launching, the premier launching of this book. Is this not true, Michael? In Alberta. So, any other place doesn't matter. We're talking about Alberta right now. So, we are honored to launch the book, and with the cooperation of the people from the University of British Columbia bookstore. Isn't that true? And others, we're very happy. This speech tonight of Michael's is going to be broadcast on our web page, so you can flick the dial to our website, and you can hear it all over again and rejoice twice. So it's a tremendous honor I have to introduce Michael, because I have this affliction of the throat that I caught on from Ottawa. You know, you get those things there. I may have to leave a little tad early. In which case, Bob Anderson, Our colleague and the moderator from the Council of Public Affairs will deal with the question and answer if that situation arises. But no more talk from me, and no talk from Michael. It's an honor to welcome you here, Michael.
The mobile mic has just fallen off of my belt, and I'm not going to put it back on because I've got this thing here.
It's always an honor to be introduced by Gordon Campbell, a real pillar of the community here in Lethbridge in southern Alberta, and also to have his wife, Sylvia, here, who taught me grade 12 social studies. Everything I know I owe to her and my parents, who are here somewhere also. I have a couple of introductory comments. One is that I apologize for being slightly underdressed. I actually arrived in Lethbridge just 15 minutes ago. Our flight, because my wife and children were on the flight also, our flight into Calgary was late, and it was a bit of a mad dash to Lethbridge. But because I am a Lethbridge boy, I knew I could arrive safely in jeans and be just as welcome. How you look, it's what you have to say. And I hope that what I have to say is sufficient to make up for the informality. The other thing I need to say is that I'm... Gordon, you're taller than I am. That wasn't what I had to say. I'm acutely conscious that tomorrow is Remembrance Day. And I'm speaking on a topic that is very closely linked to Remembrance Day. The laws of war exist to protect soldiers and to enable soldiers to fight wars in ways that kill or wound the minimum number of civilians. These are laws that civilized countries have developed over the course of the last 150 years. Not to stop war, but to enable war to be as civilized as possible under the circumstances. And in the course of my work, my academic work in this area, I have spoken to literally hundreds of soldiers and former soldiers, and almost all of them have told me of their very strong belief in these rules. They know that these rules are there to protect them. They know that these rules are there to enable them to maintain their dignity in war. And they know that these rules are there so that their side can maintain the moral high ground, which is an essential component in any effort to defeat an enemy, as I think we're seeing in Iraq right now, where the United States may have lost the moral high ground, and therefore one of its major assets in that conflict. The text I'm going to dip into from time to time is a draft of something called the F.C. Cronkite Lecture, which is the major named lecture at the College of Law at the University of Saskatchewan. I'm delivering this lecture on Monday. I'm giving you a sneak preview. And I couldn't think of a more appropriate place in which to do that. I like to think that this lecture is for you, and then I'm going to recycle it in Saskatoon on Monday. We'll just not tell the people in Saskatoon that it's anything other than that. I've been very angry with my government, the Canadian government, your government, the last 4 years. Because I think to a significant degree they've compromised on some fundamental rules as they've been sucked into the slipstream of the Bush administration's war on terrorism. They've been sucked into the slipstream in ways that they didn't need to let themselves be sucked. And as a result, I think that Canada has lost some of its ability to exercise leadership, moral leadership, political leadership, on the world stage. And the speech that I'm giving tonight is a speech that that was written in anger, in dismay, at a government that had the opportunity on repeated occasions the last 4 years to do the right thing by the laws of war, and on at least a few occasions chose not to. Now, for decades, Canadians were at the forefront of efforts to protect human beings during times of both peace and war. In 1948, a McGill law professor named John Humphrey drafted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. He was the first director of the Human Rights Division within the new United Nations. In 1956, then Foreign Minister Lester B. Pearson pioneered the concept of United Nations peacekeeping, which is directly linked to the laws of war in that it attempts to bring a peace between warring parties so as to protect the lives of both soldiers and civilians. And for that effort, of course, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. In 1994, then Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire served as force commander of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Rwanda and struggled valiantly, if unsuccessfully, to convince the member states of the United Nations Security Council, not the UN as an organization, but the member states of the UN Security Council, to stop an unfolding genocide. Upwards of 700,000 people were hacked to death with machetes. Dallaire tried with all his might to do the right thing, to ensure that the prohibition on genocide, the most fundamental rule of the laws of war dating to the Genocide Convention of 1948, was implemented. And of course it was not. In the late 1990s, then Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy threw his weight, first behind a convention banning anti-personnel landmines, and then behind the creation of a permanent international criminal court to try the individual violators of the laws of war. Today, another Canadian, Philippe Kirsch, serves as the first president of that judicial body in The Hague. Another Canadian, Louise Arbour, is the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Humphrey, Pearson, Dallaire, Axworthy, Kirsch, Arbour, and others. Great names, Canadian names, leadership names in the international effort to pursue and implement justice and dignity for all. We have a fine tradition, an absolutely fine tradition in this field. And for decades, the Canadian government, or rather previous Canadian governments, took international human rights and the laws of war seriously. In 1976, Canada was one of the first countries to ratify the optional protocol to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Some of you, many of you, will remember that in 1977, Sandra Lovelace, a Maliseet woman from New Brunswick, used this mechanism to file a complaint against Canada with the United Nations Human Rights Committee. She alleged that the Canadian government had violated international law, not the laws of war, but international human rights directly related, when it stripped her of her status and rights under the Indian Act after she married a non-native man. Now, the UN Human Rights Committee upheld her complaint, and the Canadian government made history, world history, by being the first country in the world to abide by a recommendation of the United Nations Human Rights Committee. It amended the Indian Act to make it consistent with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. It maintained Sandra Lovelace and all Aboriginal women's rights under the Indian Act, even if they married a non-native man, and their children therefore maintain those rights also. And today, Sandra Lovelace sits as a senator in the Canadian Parliament, another name that perhaps should have been added to my list, a real pioneer, in this field in a global and not just a Canadian sense. We've had our downsides. In 1993, members of the Canadian Airborne Regiment tortured and killed a Somali teenager during a peacekeeping mission on the Horn of Africa. But to a surprising degree, the Canadian government did the right thing in response. Several paratroopers were court-martialed for their role in the atrocities. One served 5 years in jail, and the regiment was subsequently disbanded. That's taking a violation of the laws of war seriously. Now, a commission of inquiry did find that most of the senior officers involved in the deployment had failed in the performance of their duties, and unfortunately, none of them were ever tried. But my point, my critical point, is that in 1993, 94, 95, much more than lip service was paid to the rules governing the treatment of detainees in Canadian custody. During the 1999 Kosovo War, Canadian fighter pilots, CF-18 pilots, who trained with their American counterparts, were deliberately not assigned as wingmen or wingwomen to U.S. pilots. They were not so assigned because Canada had ratified the first additional protocol to the 1949 Geneva Conventions, while the United States had and has not. And Canadian pilots, therefore, were and are subject to more stringent requirements concerning the protection of civilians. And so they are not allowed to respond to certain threats, such as anti-aircraft fire coming from a school or hospital, in the same way as a U.S. pilot is allowed to react. And so they are completely unreliable wingmen. Because the American pilot sees fire coming from a hospital and thinks, all right, I'm going in, I'm going to blow this place up. And the Canadian pilot sees fire coming from a hospital and says, I'm turning my plane on its tail and getting out of here ASAP. They just don't work very well in pairs. And that's a result of the fact that the Canadian government has taken the laws of war more seriously than the United States, taken on stricter obligations than the United States. I give you those random examples to paint a picture of Canadian policy before September 11th, 2001. And of course, the terrorist atrocities on that fateful day in New York and Washington changed the world in undeniable ways. And there was at the same time a discernible change of approach on the part of the Canadian government to the laws of war and to fundamental rights, human rights, for people in detention. During operations in Afghanistan in late 2001, early 2002, Canadian soldiers were ordered by their American commander to lay anti-personnel landmines around their camp. The Canadian officer in charge of the Canadian soldiers did the right thing, refused to follow the command, citing Canada's obligations under the Landmines Convention. Now, U.S. soldiers, who aren't subject to those restrictions because the United States has never ratified the Landmines Convention, laid the mines instead. And the Canadian officer and his soldiers were told to build their camp within the landmines perimeter. In fact, the Canadian government argues that the convention, although it says that indirect reliance on landmines is prohibited, should actually be interpreted to allow indirect reliance on landmines laid by allies. That is the Canadian position today. It's hardly a position that reinforces our country's claim to be the leading proponent for the total elimination of anti-personnel landmines, given that most of our operations involve the United States and that the United States is not bound and therefore is always available to lay mines for us. And the Canadian interpretation is further strained by the fact that at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, the entire perimeter of the airbase is protected by anti-personnel landmines that were laid by a country that was and is not an ally, namely the Soviet Union. And Canadian soldiers rely on those landmines to this day. But I'm actually more concerned about the issue of detainees and the treatment of people in custody, whether Canadian or foreign. In January 2002, Canadian Special Forces soldiers, JTF-2, captured suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan and handed them over to the United States military. You may remember this. There was a bit of a scandal because the then defense minister forgot to tell the prime minister. The prime minister was slightly annoyed when it was discovered that he had given incorrect information in the House of Commons, having not been told the correct information by his minister. 6 months later, the minister was demoted for ostensibly other reasons. But in any event, this issue of detainees is one that should resonate with you from January 2002, particularly because they took place just days after United States Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had refused to apply the Geneva Conventions to detainees from Afghanistan who'd been sent to Guantanamo Bay. He'd refused to abide by Article 5 of the Third Geneva Convention, which requires that so-called status determination tribunals made up of three military officers, requires that such tribunals be convened in any instance where there's any doubt as to whether a detainee might be a prisoner of war. Now, everyone else in the world looked at the Taliban and said, well, you know, there's a case here. These guys are actually fighting in an organized way for a government. Perhaps they're not wearing normal uniforms, but they're carrying their weapons openly, and this is pretty close to the definition of prisoners of war. Rumsfeld said, no, I don't care. I don't need to convene tribunals. The Geneva Conventions don't apply in this new war on terrorism. In my view, Canada, by choosing to hand those detainees over, also violated the Geneva Convention. We violated the Geneva Convention by handing the detainees to a country that was in probable violation of the convention by refusing to convene these status determination tribunals. But I am pleased to say the transfers did not violate Canada's obligations under the 1984 Torture Convention, since in January 2002 there was no reason to believe that U.S. forces would abuse detainees under their control. Today, we know better. Photographs, news reports, official investigations into abuses at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, Guantanamo Naval Base in Cuba indicate that, at best, the U.S. military has failed to educate its soldiers about human rights and the laws of war. At worst, the revelations suggest a policy of law-breaking that extends all the way up the chain of command to Donald Rumsfeld's office and to the Oval Office itself. Leaked legal opinions that seek to justify torture, the denial of access to lawyers, and the removal of detainees from occupied Iraq in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention provide yet more cause for concern. Just last month, the U.S. military launched an investigation into television footage purportedly showing a group of U.S. soldiers burning the bodies of two dead Taliban fighters. That would be a violation of the laws of war. Desecration of the dead of an opposing armed force. 2 weeks later, two U.S. soldiers were charged with assault for allegedly punching two detainees in the chest, shoulders, and stomach at a military base, also in Afghanistan. And also, again last month, the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization of considerable and honorable pedigree, announced that autopsy reports on 44 prisoners who died in U.S. custody in Iraq and Afghanistan indicate that 21 were victims of homicide. Republican, right-wing Republican, Senator John McCain has been the strongest advocate within the United States for respecting the rights of detainees. And there's a reason for that. John McCain was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 3 years, and he knows how important these rules are. I haven't spoken with McCain himself. I've spoken with other former American POWs from Vietnam. One of them said to me once, "Look, my captors violated the Geneva Conventions, but were it not for the Geneva Conventions, they would have killed me." Last month, John McCain sponsored a bill in the U.S. Senate that would bar cruel and degrading treatment of any prisoners in U.S. custody. The proposed legislation has been strongly opposed by Vice President Dick Cheney. Opposing a piece of legislation that calls for respecting the rights of prisoners and not subjecting them to torture, cruel, and degrading treatment. How ridiculous a position is Cheney's? He suggested a compromise, Mr. Cheney, that would have seen the CIA excluded from the prohibition. Despite Cheney's objections, the Senate, which is Republican-controlled, actually did the right thing and voted 90 in favor, 9 against the bill. It's going to pass the House of Representatives, too. But President Bush has already vowed to veto it at that point. Going to veto a bill that would require any prisoners in U.S. custody to be protected from torture, cruel, or degrading treatment. It's incredible that our closest friend and ally, a country that has led the struggle for human rights since its very inception in 1776, has fallen to such a low. Earlier this month, the Washington Post reported that the CIA were operating a series of covert prisons, so-called black sites, in a number of foreign countries, including in Eastern Europe. According to the Post, a remarkable reporter named Dana Priest, and I quote, "Virtually nothing is known about who is kept in the facilities, what interrogation methods are employed with them, or how decisions are made about whether they should be detained or for how long," end quote. Furthermore, the Post reported, quote, "CIA interrogators in the overseas sites are permitted to use the CIA's approved enhanced interrogation techniques, some of which are prohibited by the UN Convention on Torture and by U.S. military law. These tactics, these techniques, include waterboarding, in which a prisoner is strapped to a board and immersed in water and made to believe that he or she is drowning. Under current U.S. law, under a presidential directive issued shortly after 9/11, the CIA is allowed to do this. Under international law, the CIA is strictly prohibited from doing this. In addition to covert prisons, the United States also subcontracts interrogators to the notorious intelligence services of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. This practice, sometimes referred to as extraordinary rendition, and it is extraordinary in the worst sense of the word, has resulted in the torture of a number of Canadians, including Maher Arar, Abdullah Al-Malki, Ahmed Al-Mati, and Muyed Nuruddin. Difficult names to pronounce for a white guy like me. but they're just as Canadian as all of us. Earlier this year, Professor Stephen Toop, formerly Dean of Law at McGill University, my first teacher of international law, was retained as an independent fact finder by the judicial inquiry into the Marhar Arar affair. He issued his report, a 23-page single-space report, just a couple of weeks ago. It's on the Arar Commission website. I would urge you to read it. If you don't have the time for 23 pages, read the remarkable editorial in the Globe and Mail, a newspaper that I write for frequently and almost always disagree with. On this occasion, I agreed with the Globe. And they said, look at Marhar Arar. Here's a man who has told the truth. Here's a man who has been tortured. Because that's what Toop found. He found that there was no doubt whatsoever that Arar had been tortured, including by being subject at one point to 18 straight hours of interrogation, during which he was beaten on his palms and wrists with a steel cable 2 inches thick, and being confined for 10 months to a cell that measured 3 feet by 6 feet by 7 feet high. And Marhar Arar is not a small man. Toop also concluded that, and I quote, the effects of that experience and of consequent events and experiences in Canada, including the incredible skepticism expressed by the Canadian government as to his allegations, have been profoundly negative for Mr. Arar and his family. Although there have been few lasting physical effects, Mr. Arar's psychological state was seriously damaged and he remains fragile. His relationships with members of his immediate family have been significantly impaired. In other words, his relationships with his children. Economically, the family has been devastated. End quote. Toop added, with reference to Arar's courageous battle to clear his name, quote, Mr. Arar strikes me as a person with what one might describe as moral courage, end quote. I would add Marhar Arar's name to the list of great Canadians who struggled for human rights. For more than 1 year, the Canadian government resisted pressure to establish an inquiry into possible involvement by the RCMP or CSIS in Arar's rendition and torture, and would successfully have resisted were it not for the determined and eloquent efforts of Arar's wife, Monya Mazig. Canadian government is still resisting establishing an inquiry into what happened to Al-Malki, Al-Mati, and Nureddin, even though Toop found all three of them also to be credible witnesses. The Canadian government is refusing to follow a recommendation from the United Nations Human Rights Committee on this issue in not forming an additional commission or commissions. Fortunately, we now know something of what happened. In September 2004, an internal RCMP investigation, a leaked internal RCMP investigation, concluded that at least one of their officers learned of the U.S. plans to deport Arar to Syria before he was flown there, but did not immediately pass this information on to other members of the RCMP. The internal RCMP investigation also concluded that the RCMP considered and then rejected the idea of going to New York to question Arar themselves because none of their own aircraft were available and commercial flights were too expensive. Earlier this year, in testimony before the Arar inquiry, Superintendent Michel Cabana, the senior officer in the RCMP investigation, said they later suspected Arar was being tortured, but nevertheless offered to share information concerning their investigation into him with the Syrians. Cabana said, and I quote, if all my supervisors around the table and all my seniors, people more senior than me, think that it's my mandate and protecting the Canadian public, I will go forward and share the information. End quote. There are some remarkably good people in the RCMP. In fact, I suspect the vast majority of them are, but some of them clearly are not. We're still awaiting the final report of the Arar Commission, more than 2 years after Arar was released. But in the interim, in the 3 years or so, actually 2 years, two and a bit years since he was released, the Canadian government has offered no assistance to him or his family. No assistance, financial or otherwise. Nor indeed have they offered any help to the other Canadian torture victims. Now, I don't know about you, but I think our government ought to do better by these men, who we now know are torture victims and who, it seems, were tortured in part because of our failures as a country to look after them. It's in this broader context of failings by the United States and failings, I suppose, by our own country, that we must assess the announcement just 2 months ago that Canadian soldiers, Canadian special forces in Afghanistan have again acquired detainees and again transferred them to U.S. custody. Because we now know that the U.S. tortures people. The full scope of the Geneva Convention no longer applies to Canada's operations in Afghanistan because we are there with the full consent of the new sovereign government in Kabul. But Canada is still bound by Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions that applies to armed conflicts that are not of an international character. And Afghanistan and Canada are both party to the Geneva Conventions and thus Common Article 3. Common Article 3 stipulates that, quote, persons taking no active part in the hostilities, including members of armed forces who have laid down their arms, are absolutely protected from violence to life and person, in particular murder of all kinds, mutilation, cruel treatment, and torture. Common Article 3 also prohibits outrages upon personal dignity, in particular humiliating and degrading treatment. Canada, by transferring detainees to a foreign military that has recently committed violations of precisely this kind, risks complicity in breaches of the Geneva Conventions. We're also taking serious chances with the 1984 Torture Convention. Article 3 of that convention decrees that, quote, no state party shall expel, return, or extradite a person to another state where there are substantial grounds for believing that he would be in danger of being subjected to torture. Now, given what we know about practices at Abu Ghraib and Bagram Air Base, the possibility that our detainees that were in our custody, will be tortured in U.S. custody is real. And we cannot, under the torture convention, hand them over. It's as simple as that. Transferring our detainees to U.S. custody might even violate the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The Charter safeguards security of the person. It affirms that everyone has the right not to be subjected to any cruel and unusual treatment or punishment. Now, the Supreme Court has held that extraditing an accused murderer to face capital punishment in the United States would violate the Charter. This was the Burns and Raffi case from, about 6 or 7 years ago, one of Eddie Greenspan's great human rights victories. When he's not defending the nastiest of the nasty, he's actually a human rights activist of a very admirable kind. And defending the nastiest of the nasty is actually a human rights role in itself. So we know that the Charter applies to actions of the Canadian government that result in breaches of Charter rights outside of Canada. That's the Burns and Raffi case, the extradition to the death penalty in the United States. If you push a person out of a window, it's not the ground that kills them, it's you who does. To give you an analogy, we push these people into foreign custody where they will be mistreated. It's us who's responsible, not the person or persons, not only the person or persons that causes the direct harm. So logically, these same provisions apply to the transfer of any detainee from Canadian custody to U.S. custody if torture is possible, and also coincidentally, if the death penalty might be applied. Now, Bill Graham has told me, he told me yesterday, personally, that Canada always seeks and receives assurances that any transferred detainees will be treated properly. I told him that that was insufficient. Torturing governments almost always seek to conceal and deny their actions. What matters is their track record. In this case, the recent appalling track record of the United States. Now, Bill Graham also said to me and has said in public that Canada must transfer its detainees to U.S. custody because we lack the facilities in Afghanistan to hold them ourselves. I beg to disagree. I said, Bill, we are the eighth largest economy in the world. A detention facility must cost less than our federal government surplus. I would suspect a tiny fraction of 1% of our surplus. It's not a question of capability, Bill. It's a question of political will. And how much do you value your legal obligations? In my view, there's no excuse for playing fast and loose with these fundamental rules or seeking to justify their violation on the basis of expediency. I mentioned at the beginning that I am acutely conscious that tomorrow is Remembrance Day. Because the rules that I've been speaking about were developed most forcefully in large part in the aftermath of the Second World War. And the veterans who we will celebrate and thank tomorrow, whether living or dead, were part of a generation that, among other things, drafted the United Nations Charter, which most people think is about peace and security, whether countries can go to war, and not about what they do in war or how they treat people in their custody. We think about those things as being left to more specialized treaties like the Geneva Conventions, the Genocide Convention, the International Covenants on Human Rights. But I thought, given that tomorrow was Remembrance Day, and that we are remembering that generation and their commitment both to this country and to the kind of rules I've discussed this evening, that I should read to you the first three stanzas of the United Nations Charter of 1945. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold suffering to mankind, and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small, and to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained. And then it goes on and talks about all the rules of the UN Charter. So the UN Charter, the constitution of international society crafted by people who had witnessed two world wars, the Holocaust, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the firebombing of Dresden and Hamburg, it begins by talking about saving succeeding generations from the scourge of war, reaffirming faith in fundamental human rights, and establishing conditions in which treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained. That's what it's all about. And that's why Remembrance Day is a good time to talk about these rules. I hope that you're just as angry as I am by now. And I want to close by making one small suggestion. When I was talking with Bill Graham yesterday, I realized that he was uncomfortable about Canadian policy on these issues, not because he said he was, but just because of the way he looked when I raised these issues. Bill Graham is an international lawyer. He spent 10 years as a professor of international law at the University of Toronto. I'm absolutely sure that he knows that his government is in the wrong. Well, you can contact Mr. Graham in about 10 different ways. All you need to do is go to his website, www.billgraham.ca. It will give you email addresses, fax numbers, telephone numbers, postal addresses. What, there are roughly 40, 50 people in this room. Look, right here, we can manage 500 communications to Mr. Graham on our own, saying, Bill, you're wrong. You can do better. We can do better. Build a detention facility in Kandahar. For a start, please, we'll forgo that additional $1 in tax cut next Monday. I think that these things are important. And I think that in the aftermath of 9/11, too many people in this country have been caught up in the inflated rhetoric coming from south of the border. And that our own governmental leaders have been spending too much time talking to their American counterparts and have forgotten about what's important. We can fight the so-called war on terrorism. I prefer to think of it as a struggle against criminal behavior involving violence against civilians. But we can fight this battle and win it while not compromising on our fundamental beliefs, our principles, and these rules. We're infinitely more powerful than they are as long as we can maintain the moral high ground. And we're losing the moral high ground, and that is the only risk to our victory. And it's a lesson that Canadians and Canada can begin to teach the United States by exercising leadership on these issues. Bill Graham's the perfect place to start. He gets it. I know he's uncomfortable. And he just happens to be the Minister of National Defense. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. I had about as short notice as you did getting off the plane this quickly, but we'll have at it. You've heard Michael's comments laid out like the scholar he is, clear and careful. What sort of comments or questions or what areas do you want to push Michael a little bit? I think you'd appreciate a push here or there. So, back there so people can hear what you say and can assemble in some kind of a queue. Now, you have a question?
The question is, what are the
it's working.
Okay, please. One more time.
How far will we go to for people that own land, ownership, and the rights, and how the law and the lawyers protect? They didn't protect me. The lawyer says, settle out of court for $50,000. The guy was pushing me for $250,000. So I was left naked, like a jailbird, with just about without a G-string, according to law or finances. This guy accuses me of not letting him irrigate when I paid $7,500 by my Camaro 7 years ago to irrigate. So this goes through, and the new owner has got the irrigation sanitary going. I had wonderful promises of free pipe, electricity, and water for life.
You registered your question, I think.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Got a future, hasn't got a farm, no buildings. It's
so we're not entertaining speeches, just questions, okay?
Well, actually, the gentleman does have an important point. I'm not a specialist in domestic law, especially property law. But obviously, a country that wants to exercise influence internationally on human rights and the laws of war and international law generally has to have a strong rule of law system domestically also. So a functional justice system that treats all people equally and protects their rights is absolutely critical within a country that wants to have influence on the world stage. I could make a reference to the current situation in Iraq, actually, but I won't.
Well, here comes a straightforward question.
With a little preamble.
Yeah, I know.
So you need context. You should know that, Bob. I'm sure.
Not too much context, though.
Okay, thank you. Sound like Gordon. Has he been cloned? My comment, I guess, initially would be that I share your anger, although years ago I learned to try and control my anger so that it doesn't eat us up inside. That's just a passing comment. I also share your philosophy about what I sense to be your annoyance, anger with the wrongs that have been perpetrated by the Americans and that we may be aiding and abetting in some of our actions. Having said that, and agreeing with your philosophy and sharing your anger, I have a very practical question. How does the government of Canada, whether it's the Minister of Defense or Industry and Commerce or Prime Minister, any of them, persuade the Americans that, number one, the Americans are doing wrong, and secondly, that Canada should not be aiding and abetting or cooperating and passing over detainees and breaking the conventions? I mean, I agree with you, but the practical question is how do you do that? If you're the Prime Minister, for example, we'll give you the top position in Canada, how do you do that?
It's a question that is asked all the time. The single reason that's put forward by the current government for almost every policy that involves the United States is, well, they'll just do it anyway, so we better go along. But I want to tell you just it will seem like a complete tangent, but it's a story that's directly connected. A couple of months ago, the Canadian government decided to take a stand on an issue of U.S.-Canada relations that most of you would not have heard of. I'm not talking about softwood lumber. I'm talking about the porcupine caribou herd, which will be devastated if drilling for oil is ever allowed in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge
on the Alaskan side of the border between Alaska and the Yukon. And a lot of people within the government bureaucracy didn't think that this was serious. The politicians, but surely they knew that Bush was going to go ahead and drill anyway, and it was a lost battle, particularly when it was changed to a provision in the budget appropriations bill, which only requires 51 votes in the Senate. And I was involved with this peripherally, and there was a real sense within the bureaucracy that, oh, here we go again, you know, we're standing up to the United States and we're going to lose. But for some reason, the Prime Minister and more importantly, the Minister of the Environment, Stéphane Dion, stood up. Now, I don't know whether their standing up had an influence on something that happened last night, but last night, the President and his supporters were forced to retract that provision from the budget appropriations bill. The President has lost in his effort to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. The porcupine caribou herd has been saved. And my guess is that some of those moderate Republican senators who looked at the situation said, hey, Canada's standing up on this one. Wow, this must be serious. To take the example of detainees and torture, it's taken 4 years for John McCain to put forward his bill and for 90 of 100 senators to support his bill that would outlaw torture and mistreatment of detainees. Maybe if Canada had stood up earlier, it would have only taken 3 years to get to this point. The President is losing domestically on this and other issues now. Canada does have a voice. Moderate Americans, both Republican and Democrat, respect our opinions. And when we just lie down and let an administration walk all over us, we lose that most crucial influence, not internationally, but domestically within the United States. I had an email this morning from a friend of mine who was in charge of lobbying Congress on behalf of the Canadian government. I'd sent him an email last night, just a short congratulations, and he sent an email back and said, the moral of the story is always speak up and never give up.
So just back to my question, what would you do if you were the Prime Minister of Canada, given this handing over of detainees?
Well, I would say, look, I think we should be in Afghanistan. Afghanistan needs us. It will be a failed state if we're not there. It's better to have Canadians who know how to interact with local communities than U.S. Marines who shoot everyone they see. I think we should be there. I don't want to see Afghanistan descend into the kind of anarchy that exists in Iraq. It's close, but it's not Iraq. But I think that if we're prepared to make that commitment, we should also be prepared to build a detention facility of our own and send 100 RCMP officers over, or Corrections Canada officials, and do it properly, and not pretend that we somehow don't have the capability to do this in the right way. And that would in turn send a signal to the international community that there are countries that want to cooperate with the United States when the United States is doing the right thing and will not cooperate the moment the United States is in danger of doing the wrong thing, just like we did on Iraq. In terms of the decision to go there, we stood up to them on that. We stood up to them on missile defense. We can do it. Missile defense has been scaled back in terms of budget appropriations. The Iraq affair is turning into the biggest foreign policy mistake since Vietnam. We've been on the right side of these issues when we stand up. And what I don't understand is why we have this assumption that standing up is somehow bad. When we do it well for the right reason. And sometimes when we do it against all of the naysayers who say, oh, no, that's a waste of time. The United States will just go ahead anyway. So I just want to see a little bit more spine in Ottawa. And I don't think there's any reason for us to be ashamed or insecure. I mentioned that we're the eighth largest economy in the world. We're also the United States' largest trading partner, not just the other way around. They're our largest. We're their largest. We're the largest supplier of oil to the United States, largest supplier of natural gas. We're a member of the Commonwealth, La Francophonie, the Quad within the WTO. We're a member of the G7. We've got the second largest chunk of real estate on the planet. We're a big, important country. We can stand up to them sometimes.
Henry is being gracious, so you go ahead.
Maybe you could highlight my question, or maybe you'd be able to help answer this. What way would a person be able to press charges if they wanted against George Bush for possibly the fear that they won't wake up in the morning as a Canadian because their home will be bombed while they're sleeping or at any time, just because my quality of life has been lessened because of this war, has affected a lot of people. And maybe also just like solidarity-wise, you know, it's just not making sense as why someone as George Bush has still a presidency over the country just isn't making sense. So like you were saying, we could send emails to Bill Graham.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how fighting with the pen a lot of the time brings like great benefits, small steps forward. Because fighting a superpower, I think, I'm not very good with my politics, but like the United States Armed Forces, or what they're called, is, you know, we can't totally burn ourselves out. Like being their number one, their neighbor, you know, they're sending us so many other problems too, like with their trash and their waste facilitations and all sorts of things, that enough is enough.
Okay, let me see if I can answer your first question. But also I'm going to mention something else, too, in terms of, you know, emailing a politician. One of my students was complaining to me about something that the Prime Minister had said. And I said to my student, I said, well, send him an email. Tell him that you disagree. He said, oh, no, it doesn't matter. That would be a waste of time. I said, no, just do it for me. Do me a favor. Send the Prime Minister an email. A respectful email, but just indicate. He runs into my office an hour later and said, I sent an email, and 30 minutes later, the Prime Minister's assistant emailed me back, thanking me for my comments and telling me that he would communicate my thoughts to the Prime Minister. This kid is looking at me going, oh, boy! Right? So few people do it. Email, write letters, make phone calls. You want to magnify your influence as a citizen 1,000-fold. One email to one politician does that. If you want to magnify your influence 100,000-fold, be an activist every day like Sylvia and Gordon have been for their entire lives. These people have much more influence on Canadian politics than just about any other Canadian because they try. That's it. On the issue of prosecuting someone like George Bush or Donald Rumsfeld, you can't do it in a national court. In a Canadian court, for instance, at the moment, because they have the protection of diplomatic immunity and state immunity. And there are good reasons for that. We still want to be able to negotiate with them about trans-border issues, even if they are war criminals, right? You have to be able to deal with people who are in power, regardless of whether they are human rights violators or not, regardless of whether they're democratically elected or tyrants. You just have to. The moment, though, that they cease to hold office, things become much more interesting. And last year, a group of my students wrote a legal opinion, because I had mentioned to them that I was going to be at a conference with Jamie Cameron, who is the chief of the Vancouver City Police. And they were interested in doing something about Rumsfeld and torture. So they wrote a memorandum for the Chief of Police of Vancouver is saying, dear Chief Constable, when Donald Rumsfeld ceases to be Defense Secretary and comes on a salmon fishing trip to British Columbia, this is what you should and must do. And they laid out the case against him under Canada's new war crimes legislation that has been used to implement our ratification of the International Criminal Court. I mean, yeah, there were lots of legal complexities, but the point that they made was that there was a serious case to be addressed, and that, like any other alleged war criminal, the chief constable would have a duty to arrest the gentleman concerned and investigate the allegations and the jurisdiction available, and my students showed that the jurisdiction was there. That may be why Rumsfeld is hanging on as defense secretary. The final point to make in this context is that it's the possibility of prosecution up the chain of command that is the primary reason why the United States is opposed to the International Criminal Court. And I told people for 4 or 5 years that the United States had nothing to worry about from the International Criminal Court because the U.S. had one of the world's best military justice systems, and that that military justice system would inevitably prosecute anyone who violated the laws of war, regardless of whether they were a private or a general. Well, we saw what happened at Abu Ghraib. The privates were prosecuted. It didn't go up the chain of command. The U.S. military justice system has demonstrated itself unable to prosecute senior officers or defense secretaries. The United States has a reason to be worried about the International Criminal Court, because if they were subject to it now, and they're not, they haven't ratified the statute, and neither had Saddam Hussein, but were they subject to its jurisdiction now, the independent prosecutor for the court would quite correctly be investigating allegations against the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Defense Secretary.
Just before Hannah starts, I hope you listen carefully to Michael's approach. Wasn't exactly roundabout, but it was certainly effective. But I don't recommend that you send emails directly to George Bush. My experience with that on a couple of three occasions is that I get a reply very promptly that makes the offer, if any of our family is having weddings, anniversaries, or birthdays, he would love to send them good wishes and greetings. And that's the reply. So try some of Michael's approaches. I think more effective. Henning, go ahead.
Yeah, I wonder if you can expand the dateline of the U.S. I'm going to use the word noncompliance, but if we're not talking about laws that were in existence yet, how can you say noncompliance or lack of moral authority in relation to the treatment of prisoners? It's not a recent thing. There were the Eisenhower camps, the Rheinwiesen. My father was a prisoner there after World War II was over in the European theater, where rations were minimal, less than for prisoners of war. How far back does this go in terms of American? Is that the norm for America in the world in terms of its treatment of prisoners? I call that torture, by the way, too. It's not a short-term torture. It's a long-term torture. Yeah. But anyway.
There were violations of the rights of prisoners of war on both sides during the Second World War. The sort of Hogan's Heroes stereotype was not all that accurate. I agree with you, and Eisenhower's camps are a very sorry moment in American history. But it's not a coincidence that the Third Geneva Convention, which is all about the protecting of prisoners of war, was negotiated and adopted in 1949. There were people, including within the United States, that realized that horrific things had been done to prisoners of war and that stronger rules were needed. There were rules prior to the Second World War, but they weren't as clear and stringent as the rules that were adopted afterwards. And this is what one sees. The rules protecting soldiers arose from a Swiss businessman named Henri Dunant, who witnessed the battlefield after the Battle of Solferino, Italy, in the mid-19th century. Essentially, thousands of wounded soldiers being left to die in complete agony. There was no conception of rights of wounded soldiers, no conception of them deserving any treatment at all. And Henri Dunant went back to Geneva and drew together a collection of his friends and said, we must change this. And the result was the International Committee for the Red Cross. It's a wonderful example of one person changing the world. out of the sheer moral compulsion to do something. It's heck, it's a lot better than writing emails to the defense minister, right? Set up the ICRC. But it's a small example of how this area of law, like all other, I think, positive movements in world history, are begun by one or a handful of people and do not change the world. There was a wonderful op-ed in an American newspaper a couple of days ago. I wish I could remember which one. It was written by an American who served in Afghanistan with the Mujahideen during the Soviet occupation of that country in the 1980s. And he talks about how the Soviets were doing horrific things to Mujahideen that they had captured, and how the Americans leaned very hard on their allies, the Mujahideen, to not reciprocate in kind, but to treat captured Soviets in accordance with the Geneva Conventions. And after a year or so, the Soviets began to behave as well. International law can only be implemented and maintained if both sides respect the rules, and the only way you can get both sides to respect the rules is if one side starts by respecting the rules. It's not just a negative phenomena that it takes one party to start to misbehave, it also takes one party to start to behave. And I think the United States has demonstrated the truth of both the positive and negative movement of that calculation. And we need to turn that around. And countries like Canada need to step into the place of the United States and say, look, these rules are important. We're going to behave in accordance with them. And when are you going to follow us? Rather than just sitting meekly by and becoming complicit in torture.
Howard?
Howard Forsyth. I'd like to bounce this into another category. It happens that this afternoon at the SACPA meeting, I made reference to the phrase, property is, what was it? How did I say that? Property is a God-given right. We have thousands of churches in Canada of all varieties, and they'll give all kinds of sermons based on extremely primitive thinking, 2,000 years old, most of it. What do you expect from the sense of sanity and leadership that does not arise out of churches and is not brought up to date the way you brought us up to date on the rules of war?
I'm off into theology now.
I haven't spent a lot of time in church recently, I have to confess. But I do know that many of the rules that I'm talking about have originated in conceptions of morality that actually were themselves rooted in religious belief. The natural law origins of these rules of fundamental protections for human beings go deep, deep into human history and are directly connected to religious belief. It is a question as to whether or not churches have been sufficiently vocal on these issues the last 4 years. The leadership in terms of human rights, fundamental protections, has been taken over by other organizations called Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch. It's a phenomenon I haven't thought about very much, but to some degree the voice of moral anger and of moral wisdom has been delegated from the religious to the NGO world, Now, it's true, of course, that many people who work in these NGOs are very religious themselves. But to some degree, this movement to resist violation of human rights has become secular in some way. The question for those, and I know there are people in this room who were active in churches. Have various churches been vocal on this point? Please.
One of the things you haven't heard on this Project Plowshares, that's the organization that speaks for all of the mainline churches in a very forthright fashion. But maybe there's others who want to react to Michael's question.
Project Plowshares does a wonderful job, but focuses its attention on disarmament and arms control. I know Ernie Regeer, who's been the executive director for a long time, know him fairly well. But they haven't been standing up on, for instance, these torture issues.
War is their main.
Yeah.
Michael, I there was an item on As It Happens this week. An Episcopalian church, priest in, which I'm not sure whether it was in Tucson, had a visit from the IRS because of a guest preacher in his church who had preached on peace. And I just wonder, had that been an evangelical church or a friend of Bush's church, it might have been a different reaction.
So you're suggesting that the IRS might be going after the Lethbridge Public Library?
I wouldn't do that. I thought that was a real symptom of our times.
And one thing that has happened, and people need to realize this, that the climate in the United States has shifted very dramatically the last couple of years. I was a professor at Duke University on September 11th, 2001, and remember how for the first year and a half after that, there were just a couple of almost voices in the wilderness expressing opposition to the Bush administration's trashing of international law. Now it's become almost commonplace. The stories that have leaked out, the torture memorandum, the photographs from Abu Ghraib, the willingness of the vice president to oppose the most sensible of bills designed to protect detainees. This is all creating a serious sense of revulsion among well-minded, decent Americans. And of course, there are very many of those. And so I guess the lesson for Canadians is, the Bush administration is faltering, and this is the moment to stand up and add our voices against what they have done and are doing. Because the sad fact of the matter is that Bush has got 3 more years. And then after him could welcome Condi. And even though the tide has turned against Bush, every possible voice has to be raised to ensure that well-minded Americans realize that he must be kept in a box for the next 3 years and that he cannot be replaced by his even more hawkish Secretary of State. This is an important thing, not just for individual Canadians, but for the future of the world. These people have demonstrated their lack of concern for international law, for human rights, for sovereignty of states, for the environment. I could go on and on and on. And finally, they're on the back foot. We're in a position where we can push back, and we need to do so now because they're smart and they will come back at us if we let them.
Other question?
Yes, I do. You're talking about responses to these things that happened as of late with the American policy in the world. But how does one actually can a person react or a group react? I get a sense of feeling that there are a lot of people that are concerned in the United States, high-profile people and actors and whatnot, and then when they speak out on policy, they seem to be muzzled, or the media seems to clamp down, or they won't even give them the time of day to report on things. Now, I'm getting this kind of, I don't know if I'm getting paranoid or whatnot, but I'm getting this sense of feeling that's happening in Canada as well on certain domestic issues as well. And I'm just wondering, are the people that are in power, are they getting this sense of control over the media and media outlets to allow certain viewpoints out and not allow, voices of other opposing thoughts to come through? Is that just me, or is this something that other people have felt too as well?
Other people have felt this, believe me. We do have a problem with the media in this country in terms of it being owned by an increasingly smaller number of large corporations, and expressing views that are more reflective of the business elite and less reflective of other Canadians. Doesn't mean that the business elite is always wrong, but they do have a disproportionate voice, partly because they're organized, partly because they're rich, partly because most politicians either are or want to be part of the business elite. The response to that is twofold. First of all, there are alternative media sources that are starting to fill the space. I'm on the board of editors of what I think is a wonderful initiative in Vancouver called the Tyee, T-Y-E-E. It's an Indian name, a Haida name for king, the king. It's an internet newspaper, www.thetyee.ca. And we have 100,000 regular readers. And it's a seriously probing, center-left, investigative journalism venue that was very influential in ensuring that the other Gordon Campbell faced a serious opposition in the BC legislature after the election a few months ago. It's not the only venue that's developing, but there are such places. The other thing that I tell my students, and I don't want to sound immodest here, but if your views are well argued, and if you're right, the regular media still has to give you space. I don't have a column in the Globe and Mail. I earn that space every single time. And sometimes it's really hard. And sometimes I need to say to the editor, look, Patrick, you and I both know that this is a really good piece and you have to run it, so stop dicking me around. You have to fight, you have to be good, you have to do a lot of work. And I'm pleased to say that it's not actually impossible for anyone to do this. If they try hard enough and they practice and they figure out how to do it well. I have a doctoral student at UBC named Anna Lucatella, who published her own op-ed in the Globe and Mail 2 weeks ago on avian flu and the compulsory licensing of Tamiflu. And she did it simply because she'd been studying what her professor does and figured out that it wasn't anything particular to Michael Byers. He just had a formula and it worked, and that she could make the recipe work for her just as easily as it worked for me. I also had the great pleasure of saying to her on the morning that her op-ed appeared, which was the morning that representatives from 30 countries met in Ottawa to discuss the avian flu epidemic, I said, Anna, enjoy the next 15 minutes. You're the most powerful person in Canada.
Well, we're coming close to the end of our time. But I do know that this is a gathering of some of the best questioners in SACPA, so there must be a few people here that haven't said anything yet. So, no, you've had one question. So if there's anyone else that has a question or an observation to make, I think we'll have to make that the last one. Is there anyone else?
Susan Giffen is my name. I'm curious, you mentioned Maher Harar and the other gentleman that I won't even try to say their names. But what about Sampson? Like, I heard him on The Current yesterday morning, and he made a really compelling case for the Canadian government letting him down as he was being tortured in where he was, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. William Sampson is very compelling, and he was tortured, and the Canadian government didn't do enough. The British government didn't do enough either. He's a dual national. And I'm very pleased that he is speaking up as he is. But I have to say, I feel even more sympathy for the four Muslim men whose names I mentioned. And there's another one who's just been released from Syria. And I feel sympathy for them for two reasons. I mean, Arar in particular. Arar didn't choose to go to Syria. He was taken to Syria. William Sampson chose to go to Saudi Arabia. He still shouldn't have been tortured. It was still grossly illegal. Very, very wrong. But Arar and these other Muslim men, they didn't choose to go there. They were extraordinarily rendited by the United States. And the other reason that I feel even more sympathy for these Muslim men is because William Sampson is going to resonate with far more Canadians than these Muslim men, because he looks like your average white Canadian man, and he sounds like it. He's articulate. He's one of us. And I think most Canadians, they look at these Muslim guys with their beards and their faltering English and the fact that they're immigrants, and it just doesn't resonate in the same way. And that's why I make the point that these five men, are as Canadian as all of us. And we failed them in an even more substantial way, because we allowed our ally, our military and political ally, to take them to Syria to be tortured. The other, I suppose, point to make is, and it's a small one, but it's an important one, because politics and power relations are part of this all too. Syria is not as powerful as Saudi Arabia. And if you're Canada and you really, really want to put the heat on Syria, you can't. We couldn't have the same effect persuasively on Saudi Arabia. We failed these Muslim men in the prison in Damascus, because there was something we could do, and we didn't do it, both in terms of stopping the Americans from sending them, and then in terms of not putting all possible pressure on the regime in Damascus. And that, to my mind, is even more serious than the fact that we didn't agitate sufficiently about William Sampson. Wronged though he definitely was.
Well, I think it's time now we'll move to a more informal stage. There are books over there for you to look at, and maybe even do more than that. There's some coffee and other things over there. But just before we do, I'd like to make a comment. You've obviously been listening to a scholar of some standing in the world, and how he goes at some of these problems with carefulness. You've been listening to a hometown boy, and that's always nice. But you've been listening to a scholar who has passion. He cares. He's compassionate. He's more than just angry, I think. He's active and doing things. And so show him our appreciation, would you please?